I just haven't, nobody had really asked for that. I could design one like that, make it a
That
little
would
more
be beautiful.
expensive. But no, this just actually what I use is what they call a PHAT or something, that spark fun cells that breaks out a connector, that I can easily connect directly to either of these boards, so it can work with either design. But all by itself, the small one can just connect to I2C on, say, a Raspberry Pi. And perhaps someone wants to do something with RTL SDR type receiver. The two would then coexist pretty well, and they could correlate magnetic variations with some lesser radio if they wished.
Yeah, that sounds good. Now, does it extend? Now, I'm still not certain I understand the interface. Can it be removed at all from the Raspberry Pi? So, can you put the magnetic field sensor outside, or is it really on a short leash there? So, it has to stay right next to the single board computer.
Well, it doesn't have a lot of distance. It's whatever you can get away with I squared C, and I haven't pushed it. I normally use it with an 18-inch unshielded little parallel wire I squared C wired that fits the connectors. And so I have it, but we've never had a chance to properly measure the baseline noise that comes from these arrangements. There possibly also are some other experiments that might be useful to do with this that don't even relate to our applications.
So I wanted to jump in here because I talked to Dave weekly because we live in the same town, and I've tested the simple board for him, and it's like when you're doing any complicated project, it's often helpful to work in steps. So he built the simple board just to get where he could read the magnetometer and all. And then he's also working on the one that fits the design of the project. So be aware, one of the more complicated parts of the design for the project is the offset pieces. So sending I squared C over 100 feet of coax or Cat 5 cable turns out to have lots of little gotchas that make the project quite a bit more complicated than just the simple magnetometer.
This is Phil. I'm sure it's in the test plan, but it would be a good idea to make sure that to see how much of the I squared C traffic is going to get back into the radio. We've had some not so good experiences with that on occasion, both at HF and then just to see what the magnetometer sees when you make sure that you exercise the bus. Something to make sure that's on the list.
Yeah, that would be really nice to know.
Yeah, it would depend just on, again, what the threshold is and what our baseline sensitivity is. Can somebody remind me, maybe Nathaniel remembers, what was the magnetometer sensitivity that we were going for here? I just literally can't remember the number.
I think we're going for between 3 to 5 nanoteslas, and I think we have we're good for 13 in actuality.
Okay, so then if then your question is going to be really important as to whether one can move the magnetometer off board or not, or whether, because in other contexts, if you had the magnetometer sitting there right next to currents flowing back and forth on lines that are twiddling back and forth, you may very well have some systematics in there that if you want to get down to that level of even relative measurement, depends, it may be tough to null out. Because of course it would be dependent on what the bus is doing, which is by definition not Gaussian, so and or noisy. So just something to think about.
Yeah, Frankie actually noticed, and of course we were using the communication board, you know, the sample communication board, but we even noticed that the serial cable changed some of the readings from time to time.
Yeah, that wouldn't surprise me at all. In other contexts, I've understood that even like a twisted pair cable for the I2C stuff can, I mean, kind of just like going back to telephone days, even the twisted pair can sometimes help there, and it's not too much more than, you know, using the standard parallel unshielded cable. So, but again, just a little playing on the bench will tell you what's going on, but definitely look for systematics that, you know, takes, if you take some data on it and then you bash away and try to subtract those out, depending on what you're doing, you know, they can or cannot vanish. We'll find out a lot, certainly in a hurry.
David, have you discussed this sort of thing with Scotty at all?
Well, concerning the interference from the other electronics and the magnetometer, that's why the extended version that's why it was designed the way it is, so that it does have the ability to be extended out by a substantial length of shielded Cat 6 type Ethernet cable and placed well away from the other electronics. The simple version was intended initially just to let me write code against it. I've had enough difficulties between the extension, just mounting the extender chip and the, and then back and forth about some of the particulars of the connectors. Scotty and I have had some differences of opinion about those things, but you know, I was having enough things slow me up there that I made these other boards just to make it simple. But for some projects, particularly Ward Silver, the things Ward Silver were talking about and other people, I think these little ones might be a more suitable solution. But I never considered them being, you know, Tom and Scotty and I all were quite agreed, I think, that this using the extender is presumably necessary for the Sirius setup.
Yeah, I think the extenders will be important for the Sirius setup, and maybe even for the less serious ones too, because I think you're really going to want to get that magnetometer sensor out of the house and out of the building and away from other things.
This is Phil. Is there's only one set of specifications? There's not like another, you know, more tolerant set for the, you know, for a something that would be this more simple thing where the magnetometer is closer. It's usually not good in a project to have two sets of specifications unless it's two different projects. But again, I'm confess that I'm kind of checking back in here after a while, and I don't remember whether there was more than one set of specs that people were going for.
No, there definitely is not a spec for the simpler one, but it was just a means of getting something that would behave, at least for the purpose of collecting, you know, interacting with the device, it would just getting it so that we had something in hand.
Oh, absolutely. That, you know, you have to crawl before you can walk, for sure. And, you know, some data is infinitely better than no data. I've been there. But I do agree with Nathaniel is, you know, it sounds like everybody's on the same page that eventually you really do have to get the sensor head kind of in a good place.
Well, Phil, I wanted to reiterate the deal with the offset is we're running the boards generally run at 3 volts. And you need 5 volts for the I squared C. So there's multiple voltages, and there was a big discussion last week about running multiple voltages and keeping them separate, because if you plug something that expects 3 volts into something that's sending you 5 volts, it can be a problem.
Oh, sure. I know as a science type that when we start looking at actual data, you know, there's data that's dominated by just random noise. That's actually good, because the more you average it, you know, the better you can reduce the fluctuations. But then there's stuff that's got systematics in it, or sort of non-nice white noise like properties or Gaussian noise. And that's the stuff that doesn't average away. It basically will stick there and be incoherent. So the nice thing is here that, you know, when the data comes in, you'll learn a lot right away about what kinds of noise are floating around in there. So it'll be very interesting to see that.
Agree.
Hey, Dave, just to confirm, too, we did pick up a set of the SparkFun extenders so that we could try them on the mock-up.
Okay. Okay. How are you going? I can't remember exactly how you might want to do that.
What we thought we would do is use the quick connects to the I2C's. And basically have at our remote location, Frankie was going to put the magnetometer board and then the a temperature sensor.
Okay. The simple magnetometer board does have a temperature sensor on it that's readable in parallel with the other with the magnetometer. But as far as what you're saying is great, the SparkFun ones will be much more limited in the length of the cable you can probably use, I believe it really only lets you, the way it's arranged, well, you'll have to put 5 volts at both ends if you want to use 5 volts. A supply at both ends of the thing, which would be good to do, but you can't put the 5 volts down the wire on those SparkFun ones. We used a different, and the pinout is different from the one we have used for the Cat6 cable.
Okay, confirmed. And just remember too that we're using the evaluation board as the magnetometer right now.
Okay. Yeah. And you only have the evaluation board and one magnetometer module, as I recall. It's been a while. But that, of course, I believe that. Well, anyway, yeah, it's good. And I'll be getting you at least one of these small modules as quick as I can to experiment with also. And though that should be interesting to experiment with the SparkFun extenders. Hopefully tomorrow I'll get some boards. Pray that they're that I haven't done anything dumb on these ones that will work with the longer range setup as well.
Okay, fine business. I guess just a couple other questions while we're on it. I couldn't remember where we landed. I know that we looked at some of the other projects, but did we determine a mounting height? And the other thing, I guess, that Frankie and I were talking about was an enclosure. Any issue with just like a 4-inch PVC handy box or something like that? Or should we try to print something? Or what do you think you'd like to see used?
At this point, I don't have strong opinions about that, and others will probably have to weigh in on that. I probably would stick it just in a piece of PVC pipe with a couple of good caps on either end, you know, a piece of 3-inch or something, and then mount it somewhere. But I can't say what's optimal for height or bearing it or, you know, anything. That's kind of above my pay grade here.
Yep, understand. And we did think about the PVC pipe. The only thing that I didn't know about was Dr. Kim, thought it might be important to make it plumb and level, and I thought that might be a little more difficult if it were inside a tube.
That's something I don't completely, you know, it's a simple question, but I can't swear I totally understand. Whether it's important to orient this thing, you know, pointing north in the way that the board manufacturer seems to indicate north should be, and whether level, you know, being level, it seems like that should all matter. But somebody's going to have to think about that and weigh in. It should be pretty simple to do it if we know what we want.
Yeah, I think you should again touch base with Human regarding the technical details of how high to mount it. You know, what is the best way to do that? I think the orientation is important. Well, we certainly need to know which way is, you know, north, which way is down, and which way is, you know, the east-west direction. So we certainly have to have that. There may be some ways to do some calibrations of it once it's actually running, and it might be good to look at that. Again, we should, you know, keep consulting Human and ask him those questions. I also just sent you the link to a paper by Chris Russell for the Education and Public Outreach for the Ground Magnetometers for what's called the THEMIS project. And any recommendations in that paper are probably pretty sound. So you can take a look at that too. That's on the TeamSpeak chat there.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, that looks interesting.
Do you have any comments, Bill?
Just 3 nanotesla. I mean, again, Heilman is the expert, but 3 nanotesla seems awfully aggressive to me. I think it just feels to me like to hit that spec, a lot of things are going to have to go in the right direction. This is just coming from some experience on a CubeSat that we're putting together where we set the spec at probably about an order of magnitude or more beyond that. More relaxed than that, just to make sure that it was a simple kind of measurement, that we didn't really have to worry about making it all the way down to the single nanotesla level. Again, I'm a little behind the times here, I suppose, but I'm assuming that number came from Heilman, who really does think that you can hit that. Nathaniel, do you have any comments about that?
That number came from the spec of the magnetometer sensor itself from the manufacturer, I believe. I think we said it was actually what it actually says is 13 nanoteslas. Is that correct, Dave?
I think so. And my feeling is that I would be nervous about trying to go for the absolute limit too, but I really have nothing to base that on.
Okay, I'll just mention something that everybody in this phone call, I'm sure, does need to be told, is that there's the manufacturer spec and there's reality, and often they do not agree. So testing it yourself is, of course, the thing to do, and we'll find out pretty soon. But that's doing pretty well if you're hitting sub 20, 30 or 20 nanotesla there. That's going to be pretty challenging. The other comment I would make, by the way, is that in terms of orientation, you know you have the IGRF background magnetic field model, and there are a bunch of algorithms I know that are floating around there. I have not used them myself, but there are other people who sense the orientation by just knowing where they're located, saying, well, I know that the background field in 3 dimensions is this. And then you try to rotate your coordinates in the 3 axes you've got until you line up with what you have. So, you know, there are ways to self-calibrate.
And I think that's something that we're really going to have to implement on this project, because I think, especially for a citizen science project, it is just too much to ask people to get it lined up exactly right. So I think we need to be able to help them out with that by having an automated algorithm to self-adjust the calibration.
Yeah, I totally agree with that. It's, as long as the channels are not talking to one another, in other words, as long as the 3 axes are reasonably perpendicular, like there's not, you know, there's a manageable amount of crosstalk between the channels, then it is really a coordinate rotation. The cell phone I'm holding in my hand here has a magnetometer there. And, you know, some of the programs self-calibrate. They tell you, okay, spin the phone in a circle for a little while. And then they take some data and they say, oh, now I know what direction they are, because like you said, Nathaniel, nobody is going to want to say, take the phone and perfectly align it to this particular bearing. So yeah, the software in the back end is going to have to do the job here.
I've just tried not to make any assumptions in anything I did. Provide the basics. So until someone tells me different.
Well, I think what you're really trying to do, Dave, is just get the board going and get numbers out, and then we're going to see how those line up, and then we figure out where to go next with that, right?
Yeah. And I've written code to extract the numbers, but I have never persuaded myself systematically that I did it right. Hjelman has given me some things that should allow me to, get a sense of what the numbers ought to be in my area and make some sort of sensible, logical guess about it. But the truth is, I'm dealing with simpler things than all that, and been plenty busy with just the boards.
Oh, certainly. This is Phil. Yeah, this is research. So, we don't know what we're finding until we find it, but you're doing the legwork of actually getting some numbers that one can sort of lean on. And then the rest of it is the interesting part, where we plot what we have and scratch our heads and say, that looks interesting. So I deeply appreciate all the hard work that's going into that. It's certainly no fun digging in the trenches there.
I hope that the boards are reasonably, the boards I'm making are don't contribute anything to the noise floor of the environment that this thing's working in. I do have this MCP9808 extremely low power precision thermometer, and I have tried to locate it more or less under the module, separated by, I don't know, the standoffs of the board. My assumption has been that is quiet, but I wanted it to be kind of where the module was, so it would give us a reasonable sense of the temperature of the module. But I didn't want to cause any problems. I suppose I could position it on the reverse side of the board. I don't know if any of that makes any difference at all, but it's just stuff to think about.
Along those lines, Nathaniel, I don't know if Hjelman has written down or had any thoughts about, there are other people who have constructed, of course, larger coils that one puts the thing in, and then you vary the coil, and so you have a changing magnetic field at a rate that you know, and so you can at least get a relative signal out of this thing. I'm assuming that Hjelman at some point is going to give us a little bit of advice about that. It's not going to be a full magnetometer calibration setup like you might find at, the NRC place up in Ottawa that do sub nanotesla calibrations for magnetometers. But there are certainly some things you can do with a loop that you run some current through.
Yeah, we'll have to talk to Hjelman a little bit more about that. But I would expect some sort of work in that regard. I know we're definitely planning on taking these things and putting them at Jenny Jump next to the science grade Fluxgate magnetometers that are already there, and see how they perform compared to that.
By the way, just as a matter of interest for the people on the call who haven't been there, so I went to the very precise magnetometer calibration facility in Canada, in Ottawa, at the National Research Council. And they had an interesting room. Of course, it was in a fully wooden building. And the place that they had to test magnetometers actually had a room with three nested coils. So the outer coil was actually driven by another magnetometer that was reference grade, and that canceled out to the zeroth order the background magnetic field. The inner coil was then running on the derivative of that. So if you had a space weather event or something like that, that would make sure that it canceled that. And only at that point did they have the inner coil that they could vary back and forth and then test the magnetometer. So, if you're going for really precise stuff, you can go kind of crazy with that. It took a lot of effort to set that up. But again, if we're talking about much more modest calibrations here, an attractive part of this project would be, hey, and by the way, you can build your own relative calibration jig with this wire and, you know, this coil you can wind yourself. And at least, you know, you should get fluctuations that look like this big, because relative fluctuations are always much easier to do than absolute.
That sounds like where it gets real fun.
That's what everybody in this project is going to be interested in when we all have these graphs and put them up and say, fantastic, that averages out. Whoops, wait a minute. It doesn't average out at that scale. What is that? Yeah, that's going to be really interesting at that point.
Yeah, I think we'll have to work on that.
Well, Nathaniel, can you tell us how things went at Hamcation in Florida?
Sure. I think they went very well. I was there only on Saturday. I got there, I got to the Hamcation itself probably around 11 a.m. or so, 10:30, 11, and went over to the Tapper booth. And I saw Scotty and John Ackerman and Bill Engelke, and the booth looked good. Scotty had his mock-ups of the Tangerine SDR hardware out there. They had one of Dave's magnetometers on display. Bill Engelke had his two Odroids, one that's acting as a data engine simulator, and the other one that's acting as the client software, and he demonstrated that and showed how you could how right now it has a built-in FT8 monitor in it. It has a number of different modes for collecting data, as a fire hose mode, a ring buffer mode, a snapshotter mode. The snapshotter mode is where it uploads a snapshot of a waterfall display every say minute or so. That could be adjustable. So all of that went very well. And then we went to the forums and I gave a half hour talk. It was an overview of the Personal Space Weather Station project and some of the science we've been doing so far. And then Bill gave a half hour talk talking about the architecture of the software for the Personal Space Weather Station. And then we had a little break. And then Scotty talked for about an hour about some of the details of the Tangerine SDR itself. I think it was very well received. Over.
Okay, good. How was there a lot of enthusiasm from attendees at the presentations?
Oh yeah, absolutely. There were lots of good questions. Both talks were very well attended. Scotty's, I think, just about packed the room. Bill and mine, it was, you know, at least 80% full, maybe a little bit more. And people were very, very excited.
Good. Sounds like it was a great Saturday for you.
Yeah, and it really was. And let's see. So Scotty also introduced me to a fellow named Martin. And Martin's an FPGA programmer, another FPGA programming expert. So I think Scotty's trying to get him to join the team. I also met some people from the Radio Jove project, including Dave Typinski, who has been on the Tangerine SDR listserv and asking for a few things. So I got to meet him in person at the Tangerine SDR booth. And as I said, I also talked with Bob Gershoff. Bob is a retired statistician, and he's going to be doing some work with the FT8 spots and things like that.
Oh, good. Does Bill plan to actually upload the spots to some collector, or does he perhaps plan to implement a collector server himself?
I think there's going to be a little bit of both in there. So I think he is going to have an option to just have it send the spots directly to the primary networks, which I think that's the right thing to do for the spots, because you really don't want to contribute back to those main systems. And then hopefully we'll also have a way to collect the spots ourselves in our database.
Oh, good. Sounds like it was a good use of everyone's time then.
Oh, yeah. And I also got to speak with John Ackerman a little bit. And he's getting ready to run some tests on the timing on some of the GPSs. And I asked the question, which Phil and Ethan and I, and we were talking about this in an email. Again, the question of will the timing or the phase locking be accurate enough? Will we be able to do things like interferometry with this system? And I know I have to go back to that email thread. I haven't read it closely enough, Bill. But that was a question I had for him.
Yeah, the thread talked about, you know, the jitter spec that you get out of the board. There's a couple of things, which is, you know, can you be phase coherent? and then how long can you be phase coherent over? So, for example, if you know that you have to make a measurement, you have to integrate over a certain amount of time to make that measurement. You want to make sure that the phase isn't wandering by more than a certain amount in the time domain. Equivalently, there's phase noise in the frequency domain. And so this, we were just trying to sort of get our minds around what seemed reasonable there.
Yeah. Did we have an answer for that, Phil?
We have not closed that loop quite yet, but we need to spend a little more time thinking about it.
So one of the things I suggested to John said he gets to see Ethan at this Geeks Lunch every once in a while. You know, maybe we can, do we need to run some experiments to get some better numbers on what we actually need? Or do we think we know these numbers?
Well, John knows a lot about timing. I mean, you know, he knows how to interpret Allen deviation curves and phase noise curves. So, you know, a discussion between John and a couple of us who actually do the measurements on the back end would probably be good, because we need to spend a little more time thinking about time scales that we want to make phase coherent measurements over. I mean, that's really the key. For an incoherent measurement, like when you're just averaging power measurements, for example, where there's no phase information, then, you know, it's not as, certainly not as, is not as stringent. It's just a root n kind of measurement. But when you have something where you really want the signal to add up coherently, because you want it to go as n, where n is the number of integrations that you're putting in there, that's going to be the trick, and we've got to be reasonable about it and not go overboard hog wild at the super professional level where it's totally inappropriate for this. So I think, Nathaniel, we need a couple of case studies here, a couple of use cases, you know, at the beginning, where we can just quantify, okay, we want to be able to integrate over 10 seconds or something like that with a phase error of no more than this. But I think we probably need a separate discussion about that.
That sounds good. Do you think we could have a discussion about that on one of those Thursday afternoon meetings, or do you think we can just do it by like email?
Let's try by email, and if necessary, we can put everybody on the phone. But I think just continuing the email thread with some poking there would probably do it.
That sounds good. Yeah, and I recommended to John, because I was asking for, you know, this information about basically, I guess, yeah, how phase coherent can things be? Can we do this interferometry? I told him to start putting together a PowerPoint presentation, like a shell of one, and then pass it around to Ethan and to you and to me, and use that as a starting point, and then we can flesh it out some more.
Yeah, sounds good. I mean, you can even simulate this sort of thing. You know, you can write a little tiny piece of Python that says, okay, you know, my jitter is this many picoseconds or something like that. Now I'm going to take some synthetic data. I'm going to put a sine wave in there, and then I'm going to add my jitter. And then I'm going to make sure that I can integrate that up to the level I want and have it still come out okay. So, you know, there are ways to do it even without the real hardware. But yeah, that would start the process. That would be great.
Say, Nathan, did you get to see the multi-TICC boards at the booth?
No, I didn't get to see the multi-TICCs.
Well, I saw an email on a different list that John says he got four. So these are the time interval counterboards, that the spec on that board is 60 PS resolution. And he's gotten four of those connected together to make a more complex time phased system.
That sounds very good, Dave.
I just wondered, because he was there and I got the email while he was at Orlando, so I was wondering if he was showing it off to people.
Yeah, I didn't see it at the booth myself. I don't remember seeing that piece of hardware there, and I think I probably would have said something if I noticed it, but I also could have just missed it.
The only problem with this is his TICC boards are $229 a piece, and you need four of them.
Yeah. John was also saying that it might be easy, relatively doable, to make these the Tangerine SDRs, you know, fairly coherent over a relatively small area or small region. So if you have a bunch of them set up in an area, say the size of a football field or something like that, it'd be easier to lock them together. But if you start doing things across the nation, it might get more difficult, or would get more difficult. So I think he was thinking of it as two different cases.
Yeah, I would agree with what you just said, that it would be much easier in a small domain.
Right, definitely.
And it's going to also critically depend on the time interval that you need to do your integration or your coherency over. I mean, this is the case with any time source, is that, you know, a good crystal will be just fine at short scales, but if you're going to get out to, you know, 100 seconds to 1,000 seconds, then sometimes that's when the steering kicks in. So, it all depends on what we're looking for and how long we need to average the data over. So it's a bit of a looped question, you know. But like, again, Nathaniel, I think we need to pick a couple of very specific initial use cases, like the Doppler measurement from WWB and what have you, and then just put some numbers on it. Okay, this is kind of what we need.
Yeah, I think that's right, Phil. I think that makes a lot of sense.
Nathaniel, quick question. Are the abstracts that John, Scotty, and I sent you adequate, or do you need anything more for the conference from us?
I'll review them again in a couple days, but I thought they looked fine to me. I thought that was just fine. Maybe I'll take a look at it again, and maybe, like Phil said, we might be able to come up with a few use cases that we need to look at specifically, but I think what you sent was fine.
Okay, very good. I just want to not have a gaping hole and not send it to somebody who needs it or whatever. Thanks.
Nathan, I've got a quick question for you. I was teaching about the magnosphere in my photogrammetry class, and I was talking about the effects of it on global positioning systems. And then I went back to both the HAMSCI site and our site, and one thing that struck me in the web page is that we kind of jump in for people that already understand a bunch of this stuff, and we don't have any kind of intro page for these citizen scientists who are supposed to be our targets of what are we trying to do and what are the interesting questions.
Yeah, I think that's a good point. I was actually looking at my at the Personal Space Weather Station page today. And it is a bit of a steep learning curve. I don't think it's very well organized. So we probably could do some work to improve that.
Well, I'll take on the Tangerine website side, but I should collaborate with you and what you put on the HAMSCI webpage.
That sounds good. And I think we actually do have a bit of material that that does help to smooth things out a bit. You know, I've given a number of kind of overview talks at Tapper and HAMSCI before that are recorded on YouTube. So maybe having those available, that could help. One thing that's kind of unfortunate is I'm told that the seminar I gave at Tapper, the Sunday seminar I gave at Tapper, the video didn't come out from that properly. So I guess we don't have good footage of that we can just put on, and that gives a lot of tutorial information. We might also be able to look around the web, and there might be some other websites that have some nice tutorials written already explaining the magnetosphere. Maybe we can link to some of those.
I did find. Oh, sorry, Phil.
That's okay. I'm just kidding, Nathaniel. You know, at the risk of 1 hour of your time, of course, you could just recreate the seminar you gave on that Sunday and just make sure that it gets recorded this time, even just as a voiceover. You know, that might also be a nice thing to do. It would require that you go back through and do it again, of course, but you already have the slides.
That's true. I could do almost like a screencast sort of thing.
Yeah, that would exactly.
I'm agreeing that that would be great. I did that a lot with make a PowerPoint and then do a voiceover and make a video for class instruction.
Yeah, you know, I'm actually supposed to give a talk over Zoom to NASA. I think it's Ames out in California this Wednesday afternoon. Maybe I'll try just recording the Zoom too, because I'm basically going to be giving an overview talk. So I might just be able to start with that footage.
Yes, that'd be good.
All right, so I'll just hit the record button on Zoom this Wednesday, and we'll see how that one comes out.
Nathan, I did find a very short, like, couple-minute video by NASA that has lots of nice graphics in it. And I was thinking of using that, if we could use it with attribution.
Yeah, usually using NASA graphics is no problem with attribution.
So it did a nice job, and then we could then start from that and say, well, we're trying to detect these things.
That sounds good.
Nathan, you probably also know there's a lot of material. It's older, but physics doesn't change too much from the Windows on the Universe site. That's Pat Reif. And so this may be just a matter of kind of doing a little poking around and finding the three or four things out there that are pretty good and that could be kind of threaded together. Especially if you've got a good recording of an overview that you've done, so that kind of ties it to the project more personally.
Yeah, I think that's good. I think you're right. If I could do something that's like an overview of the project to, you know, make it a little bit more personalized for this project. But yeah, I'm looking at the Windows of the Universe page right now. I think there's also that Comet program that they had some nice graphics demonstrating a lot of space physics and magnetospheric physics type of phenomena.
Yeah, I agree. Those are good. And you know, part of what you could provide that those other things don't is you know, the reassurance for people who are thinking, isn't this stuff over my head? You know, to just basically just say, no, this is, you know, you can participate this, and you shouldn't be scared away from it. You can understand what's going on. Here's some basics, okay? And that's the same thing that you try to do when you're actually giving talks at places like Tapper or Hamvention or something like that. And so I think with a combination of those two, that will fill the need pretty well.
That sounds good. I can work on that.
Yeah, I think it's just the hook in for somebody that's interested in science but doesn't really have all the expertise, because I noticed that in our discussions there is definitely a knowledge base that you need to have to maybe Frankie can jump in on this, but a knowledge base that we're expecting.
She stepped away for a second, but I would say that's right up her alley or Seamus's alley too, and I think that's kind of where they thought maybe they could contribute, is, you know, get other young people involved in what we're doing.
Yeah, and you know, we have to also be careful, because there are very good scientists that don't know about this field, and there are all kinds of hams. Some know about it and some don't, and somebody like me, who's been around SDR projects for 12 years, I sometimes forget what I've learned over that 12 years.
Yeah, I definitely understand that. It was fun just working with her, you know, when she started looking at the data and realizing, hey, we need a timestamp. You know, we need to be able to look at when the recordings were made and not just the number of the sample. So, you know, I think that's the kind of stuff where they'll really get interested in it.
Yep.
Yeah, I think when people go to the Personal Space Weather Station page, we really need to give them a nice, like, overview of this is what the whole project is and this is what we're trying to do. And I think right now that page is very, there's a lot of links there, and it doesn't just tell you a nice coherent story the way you'd like it to.
Yeah, we just want I don't think we should get rid of those links, but we should, like the landing page should be a little, for people that have questions about it, okay, here's an overview, and then have all the details available in other places. I remember I found on your site a web page that was one or two pages down that was an excellent summary of a whole bunch of resources. I just thought, hey, this is great.
Do you remember which page that was?
Oh, I'll look it up and send you which one I meant.
Sounds good. Yeah, I have the Space Weather Station working page has a lot of different resources listed on it.
Yeah, and that those things are really helpful.
That's good to know. So I know we're coming to the end of our time, but I do want to say, Phil, I'm quite excited that Bill Engelke is actually going to the ISWAP meeting.
Yeah. Do other people in this phone call know what that is? Maybe we ought to remind them a little bit.
Yeah, I don't think they fully. I don't think they know what it is.
So Nathaniel and I were at the American Meteorological Society meeting in January, which was in Boston. And we got approached there and in other places by one of our colleagues, Masha Kuznetsova. Jeez, poor Masha. She actually is a modeler that works for something called the Community Coordinated Modeling Center. This is a resource for the heliophysics community that NASA maintains for the purpose of actually running very, very complicated, models of the whole atmosphere and models of the Sun-Earth system, because it turns out these codes are complicated enough that the way they survive is by basically providing a facility for these things to run. The problem is that a lot of the models haven't necessarily always been benchmarked against data, but now we have different flavors of data coming in. So this particular working group was kind of initiated to actually say, hey, let's gather some more of this distributed data and let's compare it to models. And Masha had heard Nathaniel's talk at the AMS session and said, boy, you guys need to get involved with this because you are a very interesting data provider and one that is complementary to the normal professional networks that we use. And so one thing led to another, and Bill Engelke very, very nicely volunteered to go down and give a talk at this workshop and make some connections. So it not only advertises what HAMSI is doing, but it's also setting the hooks in place for the personal space weather station's data coming along and getting right into the hands of people who run first principles physics models, which is what the community really needs to improve. So it's a really nice opportunity to make some connections. And I think she was really excited about having the project involved.
Yeah, it's really good. And Bill sent me an email today that he made it to the meeting, and he said he's learned more about the heliosphere than he ever thought possible. And he said he also got to sit down and talk with Larissa a bit. So it sounds very positive.
Yeah, that's really terrific. These first principles models, by the way, this is where you sit down with literally the bag of physics equations and you say, if I understand the universe, I should be able to use a fluid model, set of fluid equations over here and a set of kinetic equations over here, and it all should just work. And in reality, when you sit there and you start comparing that with data, it works okay for short intervals. And then as you get to longer and longer pieces of data that you compare with, the models go more and more in one direction and the data stays in another direction. And eventually you throw up your hands and you say, look, there's just something really wrong with the physics-based model. Either we didn't set up the initial conditions right, or just one of these things isn't behaving like it's supposed to. And that's where you learn all the information. So really having a good set of data there is very critical, and we get to provide a really interesting set of data that is organized in a way that other networks are not.
Yeah, so hopefully that will go well. I think it will.
Sorry, I was looking up resources for Nathan.
Yes, my thing has been pinging every so often. I've seen several links fly by, so thanks, Dave. That's very useful.
Yes, thank you very much.
That's the thing. Once you retire being a professor, you don't stop professing.
I'll tell you one thing. When I got my PhD, they went through the whole ceremony and they said something at one point that's really stuck with me. They said, we wish to welcome the new PhDs to the Universal Company of Scholars, and you never lose that. Doesn't matter how old you are or whether you're retired or not. So I'm with you.
Yep.
I agree with that.
Well, anything, last comments for the group? We are at our time.
No, none here. I think it was a real good session tonight. Lots of good Q&A.
And you're one of these people that has quite a long history of working in this field, both professionally and amateur. And you just sat there and listened to us all.
Well, I'm not working on the magnetometer, so I can't add practical comments here.
Well, I did find a copy of your book on DSP, and I thought that was really good.
Well, thanks. I've gotten a lot of positive comments. It's hard to believe that was 25 years ago.
And probably wasn't a huge amount available at that time, was there?
Well, not in the ham community. There wasn't. There certainly the academic literature had a lot of material.
Yep, but it. You sit down and try to read Lyons, and it's a little bit dense at times.
Yeah, I'm going to have to bow out here, Dave. I'm going to get the minutes uploaded and get on to something else.
One comment for you. Mike was just a little bit late, so if you had any comments from the notes from the early part of the session, please be sure to get those in.
Okay, will do. Thanks.
And thanks for showing up late, Mike. Well, if no other comments, I'm going to say 73 and talk to you all next week.
User disconnected from your channel.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it, Dave, and 73 to you as well.
Thanks for me, Dave. 73.
Thanks.